We welcome back Matthew Guerrieri, G-U-E-R-R-I-E-R-I, author of the first four notes, Beethoven's Fifth and the Human Imagination, also a music critic for the Boston Globe and New Music Box online. We'll talk a bit about how Matthew got to where he is and to what it is, all the many interesting music-related and writing-related things that he does. But we're talking about the way these four notes have stood for so many different things and have served as a bridge to Beethoven, or a bloody chunk removed from Beethoven's corpus. And we're sort of moving forward chronologically in a Hegelian way, but because we're being Hegelian, at least at this moment, we're moving forward and backward, a little thesis, antithesis, dialectic, etc. We mentioned Mr. Dwight stepping back from writing about music after devoting his life to it because of Mr. Wagner, or the way he saw Wagner as being embraced around the world.
Yes.
What about Wagner and the Fifth Symphony, Wagner and Beethoven?
Wagner was very much considered himself, I think, Beethoven's natural heir, and very much talked about Beethoven a lot, wrote an entire book about Beethoven. This was right after the Prussian army defeated the French in the war in 1870, so it was also doubled as sort of a nationalistic bit of gloating. And Wagner also was a conductor himself and talked about how to conduct Beethoven. And a lot of what we think of as sort of the very romantic way of conducting Beethoven comes to us through Wagner's description of how to do it. And so it's Wagner holding out, telling people to hold out the fermatas for as long as they can possibly stand, and probably advocating a sort of much more monumental approach to the sound of the Fifth than certainly would have been common in Beethoven's time. My favorite, actually, story about Wagner is one that didn't actually make it into the book, but
oh, good.
But Wagner Wagner was very, very one of the people who was very, very much celebrated Beethoven's deafness and saw Beethoven's deafness as a sign that he was sort of a more privileged musician, that he had access to sounds and ideas that ordinary people didn't. It was sort of the musical equivalent of the blind seer.
Mm-hmm.
And Wagner talks about this quite a bit, that it was Beethoven's deafness that really enabled him to set him apart. Sort of, he was an exceptional person and it was a symbol of how he was an exceptional person. Now, in the 1860s, Beethoven's body was dug up because a bunch of music lovers decided that the grave he was buried in was not fancy enough for somebody as celebrated as Beethoven, so they built him a new monument, and they dug up his body to transfer to the new grave. But before they did, they took photos of his remains. So we do not have a photograph of Beethoven, but we do have a photograph of Beethoven's skull. And they measured his skull and found out that his skull was unusually thick.
Right.
And Wagner loved this, and he seized on this, and he said, "See, I was right." I'm paraphrasing, of course, but
yes.
See, I was right, because not only was he deaf, his skull was so thick that the outer world had such difficulty getting into his brain that it was the inner world that was privileged mm-hmm. thereby. And so that gives you a pretty good flavor of the way Wagner talked about
right.
Beethoven. And so much of the way that Wagner talks about Beethoven is very much the way he wanted people to talk about him,
right.
Which of course is a recurring theme in Beethoven interpretation.
We mentioned and talked last week about E.T.A. Hoffmann and his initial role as a sort of pan-Europeanist or pan-West Europeanist in taking up the Beethoven cause, and we talked about John Sullivan Dwight and the role he played in New England and hence in America. We're talking of Wagner, but it's a name that everybody knows. At least they know his last name. They don't necessarily know all about him, and they certainly probably don't know his role with Beethoven, and that is Grove in the UK.
Yes, Sir George Grove, who is mainly known to us today because of Grove's Dictionary, of which I can see a copy
yes,
in the studio
actually,
right
are.
Now. I can see it through the window.
You are in the one spot at WFMT where,
yes.
Looking through several walls, you can see Grove's Dictionary.
Grove's Dictionary of Music and Musicians, which is one of the standard English language music reference encyclopedia, even still today. And he was the person who initially got that off the ground and was its first editor of the first edition, actually the first couple of editions. But George Grove was really, in his own time, he was known as a great promoter of classical music. He had started off as an engineer, and through his engineering contacts, he started off as a railway engineer, and then there was a great collapse of the railway industry because people had speculated on it too much and the economy of it collapsed. But he had made enough contacts through that he was able to get a job at the exhibition at the Crystal Palace in the 1850s, which was this great Victorian celebration of stuff. It was the apotheosis of the Industrial Revolution was the exhibition at the Crystal Palace. It was just a bunch of manufacturers showing off what they could make, and this was one of the great events of the 1850s. And through that, he was able to sort of stay there because the Crystal Palace was this amazing structure that was built specifically for the exhibition, a real architectural marvel. And they liked it so much in England that they disassembled it and reassembled it elsewhere so they could have it on a permanent basis. And Grove became the secretary, which was basically he was running the joint. And one of the things he immediately started to do was started to put on concerts in the Crystal Palace because he was a great music lover. And from a very early age, he had really become fascinated by music and started collecting scores and teaching himself about music. And so when he started putting on concerts in the Crystal Palace, he really made sure that the content of the concerts and the programming was very much devoted to this idea of using music to sort of enlighten the masses and make them better people. Is very much this Victorian idea of improvement applied to music. And Beethoven was very much at the center of that. And so a lot of the Beethoven performances in England in particular started with Grove. He was the one who really promoted it and made sure that he was hiring conductors and musicians who agreed with him and who thought this was the music that should be getting put on. And Grove went so far as he wrote an analytical guide to the nine symphonies, which was based on program notes that he had written for the concerts at the Crystal Palace. The idea of analytical program notes starts with the Crystal Palace. He would write essays about the pieces so the people would be educated as they listened. And so Grove was very much made himself into a person who is in the center of the Victorian establishment. And so it's another example of sort of how Beethoven went from being this radical figure in the early 19th century to this very sort of respectable conservative figure in the late 19th century. Although with Grove, it's very interesting because if you read his letters and you read his diaries, all most of which were published after he died, he was never quite sure about Beethoven. He never thought that he really got it. It took him a long time to come to Beethoven. The first few times he heard Beethoven's music, he was baffled and just thought it was noise. And then there's a wonderful sort of letter he writes to his brother very late in his life, in which he describes waking up in the middle of the night and wondering if Beethoven was really all that and whether he had sort of, you know, wasted his life devoting so much energy to promoting Beethoven and that style of music. But Grove's idea, the whole idea of classical music as uplift and self-improvement, that's a very George Grove idea and really sort of made its way into not just Victorian life, but into a lot of the way people were marketing classical music throughout the late 19th and 20th centuries, and even a little bit today too. You can still see, we try to get away from it, but people will still occasionally try to market classical music as being necessary because it's good for you. So that starts with Grove.
Raise your child's IQ, and it's going to cause peace and love among all people, and it's going to make each of us a better person. We hope it doesn't make us worse people, but I don't know that we have much evidence beyond that. And we're going to come to the different uses of Beethoven, quote, pro and con, unquote. But I have to say, when you were telling me that about Grove and his brother and this sort of revelation question that he had, I remember in 1985, 1985, 1986, I had been in China for a period just before then, just before Tiananmen, and then I wound up when I was going to a certain type of graduate school that I had a literal roommate, had a large room in a building, and we were assigned two people in there, and he was from China, so he was in that first group of graduate students who could come over relatively freely, and now he's actually a professor in the U.S., but in the middle of the night, frequently, he would say things, "Andrew, are you awake?" I said, "Yes." "Who is greater, Bach or Beethoven?" Or, "Is the Bible true?" You know? So, but these are things that that become important because they're introduced as important, and then each culture and each society and each style of person wrestles with the thing, but the thing is there, and that's sort of what you're talking about here, right?
Yeah, and then, but it's just sort of, you know, you can convince yourself of it, and Grove certainly convinced himself of Beethoven's greatness, but something in his subconscious would flare up at night and make him wonder.
Now, the British were very much thinking in this period, as perhaps always, about enlightenment and about the good. The folks in the countries in and around where Beethoven was from were thinking about enlightenment as well, of course, but some of them were thinking about it very much in, well, the British think about it, the English, in a national way, but they wish everyone would just be that way, at least in that period. They believe that the German-speaking folks were also at this time appropriating or reappropriating or transforming Beethoven to be something about Germanness.
Yes, and that's started basically with the resurgence of Germany itself, and continued for a very long time. What's very fun is to see the reaction to that, because really, in the days before first Prussia, then Germany, was really this great power. The great power on the European continent was France, of course. And early on, you know, France came to Beethoven a little bit late. But once they sort of got the habit of Beethoven, they never gave it up. They were addicted. They loved Beethoven. They adopted him as one of their own. There's a wonderful story of one of the first performances of the Fifth in Paris, at which point, after which an audience member who had been a member of Napoleon's army jumps up and shouts, "Vive l'Empereur, long live the Emperor." Right. So they immediately adopted him as an honorary Frenchman. And of course, this got to be really problematic once Germany and not France was the most feared power in Europe. And my favorite story of that is, of course, their way around it, especially once World War I started, was they seized on the fact that Beethoven's family was originally from Flanders. So they just said, "Well, he's not German, he's Belgian." And that made it okay. And then they were able to go back to listening to Beethoven without worrying about whether they were French and they were disrespecting their homeland. So the idea of nations sort of claiming Beethoven reaches its apotheosis, I think, in World War II.
Right.
Because, and oddly enough, it's not Germany. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, it was the Allies managed to take the Fifth Symphony and make it into this great, great bit of propaganda, and this is the V for victory symbol. And this was something that was, appropriately enough, started in Belgium, because it was in the Belgian resistance were trying to figure out how to do efficient graffiti, basically. They wanted, you know, they would chalk things on the walls as graffiti to just signal things for the resistance or just to annoy the Germans. And they were chalking RAF, which they decided took too long because, you know, you got to be able to tag it and run.
Royal Air Force.
Right. And so instead, somebody in the Belgian resistance came up with using just V because it stood for victory in both English and French and Belgian, and also German, but that
Flemish,
didn't matter.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so the BBC adopted this. They said, "This is great. We can use this as a signal." And somebody in the BBC came up with the idea of using the Morse code signal for V, which is, you know, three dots and a dash. Somebody else at the BBC recognized that, well, that's the opening of Beethoven's Fifth, so we can start using that. And once they started using it, it became wildly, wildly successful. To the point where not only did the Germans try and counter it with no success, because it had already gotten too ingrained as an Allied symbol being broadcast into occupied Europe, but to the point, this is one of my favorite stories I found out researching the book, was it reached the point where the BBC would actually preface their propaganda broadcasts with the very euphemistic announcement. They would say, this broadcast contains music, which was a signal to turn it down because they were about to play the opening of Beethoven's Fifth, which in Germany at that time was a very possible sign of treason. So it was so wildly successful that they were able to appropriate it completely, this German national symbol. And in fact, a lot of the commentators have thought that was really the key to its success. It was not just any old symbol. It was one they had stolen back from the Germans and given it back to, you know, the people who loved freedom and the rest of humanity.
And then the two sides use the full symphony and playing of it to mark both victory and defeat.
Defeat, yes, absolutely. It was I believe it was
Stalingrad.
When the Germans were defeated. In Stalingrad, they German radio broadcast a moment of silence and then the Fifth Symphony. Whereas in the meantime, in the United States, they had started using the Fifth Symphony as, you know, the V for Victory thing, but they were actually using it. The New York Philharmonic did a victory concert in which the prelude was just the first few bars of the Fifth Symphony, which they arranged as a little fanfare and they put it in. Toscanini did a performance of just the first symphony and said, I won't do the rest of the piece until...
Of just the first movement.
And said, I won't do the rest of the piece until the war is over. Right. And then we actually have a recording of that performance, which is one of the fastest, most fierce versions of the Fifth Symphony you will ever hear in his life. He was fired up.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we have another amazing performance that was recorded, which was Wilhelm Furtwängler, and this was in Germany, in Berlin, in the middle of the war, and this was a radio broadcast for a great event, and in which most of the top Nazi leadership was probably in the audience,
right,
as far
say,
as we
it was
know.
Played for a room full of top Nazis.
The recording itself is, I mean, the performance itself is one of the most amazing performances of the Fifth Symphony, and it's Furtwängler's just talent and skill just on complete display. But you're left with the question of, you know, what exactly, again, you know, whose side
is
was
it support,
he really?
Is it protest? Is it?
We don't know. Was it him trying to wrest Beethoven back and giving it enough power to say, no, you can't, you know, it's too much for you to get your hands on, or was he just playing to their, you know, most martial instincts? It's hard to tell.
Right. Another example, or not so much example, another chapter of appropriation, reaction, integration, recreation comes with the role that Beethoven plays for a number, well, throughout the book, we've hardly touched on it, novelists, short story writers, and later fantasy and science fiction writers, but also particularly for black writers, orators, political figures. And there's this fascinating conjunction of the universal Beethoven, the humanist Beethoven, and the idea initially directed as a calumny that Beethoven was black.
Yes.
And then how people respond to that.
Yeah, the idea that Beethoven had some sort of African blood in his family background is a pretty old one. And, you know, people very early on were commenting on the fact that he was a somewhat swarthy character. And so this idea that Beethoven was black and was always sort of around. It was at least around the earliest positive mention I find of it was actually around the turn of the 20th century, and then it was from a another black composer, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who mentioned it. Says, you know, pretty much as you know,
Samuel Coleridge Taylor.
That's it.
Yeah, it's okay.
Not Samuel Taylor
right,
Coleridge.
Right.
Coleridge Taylor. I always mix them up.
Right.
But a wonderful composer, and but someone who was very conscious of you know, identity and that sort of thing. And he mentions it just in passing almost. And then it really took off in the 1940s and became, you know, very ingrained in the civil rights movement. People would talk about Beethoven was, you know, the percentage changes a lot. He was 1/4 black, he was 1/16 black. Malcolm X mentions this in a couple of interviews that, of course, you know, Beethoven was black and uses it as sort of a provocation.
And we should mention, too, that in at least one of those famous Playboy interviews, in terms of the integration of classical music into culture and society at different points, he not only says, as an argument point, Beethoven was black, Haydn was black.
Haydn too, yes.
And if you went on the news today and started talking about Haydn, you probably wouldn't have too many people.
I actually think it's probably telling that assertion that Haydn was black had no traction whatsoever.
Yeah.
And yet the assertion that Beethoven was black had a lot of traction, both pro and con. And it's something that, as far as we know, is not true, but again, it's something that's not particularly easy to prove one way or the other. So the idea just sort of floats out there. And to me, what's interesting about it is we think of Beethoven as this very universal sort of character, and his music is very universal, and the ideal is that anybody from, you know, any background, from any country, you know, has access to it and can claim it as their own. And yet this idea of Beethoven being black just repeatedly sort of rubs people the wrong way. And so the question is, you know, it's like, how universal really is universal? And it's sort of this intersection of you know, identity and celebrity. Because I think there's one response I quoted in the book. I don't remember it exactly, but it said sort of like, what would the reaction be, you know, if we said that, you know, so if it was people were asserting that some famous black figure was in fact white. But I think really the more important question is, would there be as big a reaction if we said some more obscure composer was black? And again, you know, sort of like, even Haydn wasn't enough to get, but to say that Beethoven is somehow, you know, we like to feel like, you know, we like to say, you know, nice things that Beethoven is universal, but apparently it only goes so far, because ultimately what does it matter? It's, you know, even if he is, the music is still there and he's still the person he is, and it shouldn't matter. And yet throughout the 20th century, whenever this idea pops up, it always engenders a very, very equal reaction. And so it's sort of, you know, it's sort of showing us in kind of a depressing way the limits of the way we can talk about universality.
Right. And you have a nice bracketing in that section with, of course, Invisible Man of Ralph Ellison and the narrator who is black but who is trying to be universal, who is into jazz and blues and maybe plays music and is also very into the Fifth Symphony.
Yes.
And then you have perhaps the most important scholar of blacks in quote-unquote classical music, Dominique René Delerme up at Lawrence, used to be down here in Chicago, who sort of almost maybe reluctantly concludes we just can't say that he was black, but .. as you've been saying.
Why, you know, and I'm of that opinion too. It's like we can't say, but what's more interesting is why
this,
do we care?
Right.
Why should we care? We shouldn't care. And yet people do care. And so it's again, it's just, and the fact that, you know, here we are 200 years later in a very different world, completely different world than Beethoven knew, and yet Beethoven is the figure around which, you know, people get upset. And so I think it's there's some, you know, that intersection I found really, really fascinating.
Before we come to the closing, for us at least, double whammies of popular culture and Theodore Adorno, let's talk a bit about Matthew Guerrieri. You are, from where I sit, very young to have this great accomplishment. but tell us about your background. You're from Niles. We don't have a lot of guests from Niles.
I grew up in Niles, Illinois, and I'm here because I'm back visiting my parents in Niles, Illinois. And I went to St. John Brebeuf School in Niles, and then I was a graduate of Maine East. And then, because that apparently wasn't enough Chicago for my education, I also went to DePaul for my undergrad, and I got a degree there in composition. And then for graduate school, I went out to Boston. Mm-hmm. I went to Boston University because I wanted to study with Lucas Foss,
right,
who was the teaching at Boston University at that time. And so that's where I ended up, and I got my degree there, and I ended up just staying there, more mm-hmm. or less. I came back to Chicago for a couple of years, but ended up moving back out
you
there.
You were writing for a publication here back then?
No. No, I didn't actually start okay. writing until just a few years ago. I was trying to make a living, trying to get a career going as a composer, which right. never really happened, but also working various office jobs and also taking musical jobs where I could. I did a lot of playing for singers, accompanying singers and
right.
coaching singers, which I loved.
So your instrument, in addition to being a composer, was piano.
Was
right?
piano,
and,
yeah.
And I have spies who were in high school with you or behind you and say that you were already pretty known for being able to play things on the piano, that they were still all taking piano lessons and you were
well, it was
busy.
It was a great escape for someone who is essentially an antisocial person. So
right.
you could just go hide in the practice room for
right.
a couple hours, and I actually got in incredible trouble when I was in grade school. I was cutting class to go
right.
off. They had a piano in a closet at St. John's, and I knew it was there, and I would cut class and just go into the closet and play piano, and nobody noticed for about a month, which I think was testament to my antisocialness, but once they did find out, that was not a good day at home. But
right.
yeah,
well, it's also another example, though, of what runs throughout your book, which is this two-faced nature of music, that it's this thing that's supposed to be good for us and uplifting, but it also has some element of danger,
yes,
and threat to society in it.
Yeah.
And that you got in trouble for cutting class to play the piano.
To play the piano.
You weren't
yes.
playing in a rock band or something.
It was a more innocent time. But yeah, but yeah, so it's,
you know, Paul Lewis, a wonderful yes. youngish pianist, Beethoven, Schubert, etc. His father was the cleaner, what we would say janitor at his school in mm-hmm. Liverpool, very working class background. And his parents turned him in as a kid when they discovered that he was climbing into a window after hours and on weekends to play the piano in the school. So his father turned him into the principal and said, "My son is the one breaking in here to play the piano." And they said, "Well, Mr. Lewis, you know, maybe you might want to think about it. This is a good thing." So I like this Beethovenian feeling of music rebelling against the very institution that's telling you to take music classes.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So why Lucas Foss? What was...
I liked his music. I remember the first time I'd heard his music, and I still remember the record. I checked it out of the Niles Public Library, and it had the John Cage Concert for Prepared Piano on one side,
mm-hmm.
and it had the Lucas Foss Baroque Variations on side B, and I loved that piece. And so I started listening to as much Lucas Foss as
right.
I could find. And I wasn't aware he was teaching. I figured he was, you know, I knew him and I always liked his music, but I wasn't aware he was teaching until my last...
Because he was also a very active conductor.
Very
so
active
like,
conductor.
Why would he have necessarily been
very,
teaching?
Yeah,
right.
he was a very constant workaholic. But my last year living in Chicago when I was at DePaul, my roommate and I, we were living in an apartment in which apparently the previous resident had been gone to Boston University because we kept getting the alumni magazine. And so one day I'm flipping through the alumni magazine and there was a interview with Luke, a short little interview with Lucas Foss. It's like, oh, that's where he teaches. And it was Lucas in his, he was on that day because the poor interviewer, he was giving her the full Lucas treatment. And at one point, I remember she was trying to ask him about, you know, his students and how he teaches. And she asked him, it's like, well, how often do you see genius? And Lucas says, every time I brush my teeth. And I said, I have to go study with this man. This is the guy. And actually, he was a fantastic teacher. And I had
he was a lovely person
great,
when you were
a great person and yeah. just a fantastic, fantastic musician and a great, great teacher. So I was very lucky to be able to do that. But that's how I ended up out in Boston. And so I spent a few years in Boston just working various random music jobs. And about, I think it was about now seven or eight years ago, I sprained my ankle in the middle of the summer. And I was still sort of working on the academic schedule. So it's like, mm-hmm. oh, summer, you get your summers off. It's terrible because you don't make any money, but it's great because you get your summers off. And I sprained my ankle really badly. And so I was laid up for like 2 weeks and I was bored. And so I started blogging. And one of the reasons I started blogging was I'm very absent-minded. And just like that summer, there had been some great idea I had and I had been toying with it in my brain and I realized I'd completely forgotten it and I couldn't remember what it was. So I'm like, I have to start writing this stuff down. So I started a blog and that's how it started. And so I just started doing that.
Soho the dog.
Every day, Soho the dog. And through that, I started doing freelance reviews for the Boston Globe. And
started getting noticed.
And started getting noticed and started getting, you know, a lot of very nice and very kind references and recommendations from other people who were writing online and just kept doing it. I think one of the great things about that I finally realized about a music career is I just decided at some point that I was going to stop worrying about where I was going to be in 10 years mm-hmm. because it's in some ways you can't because it's music is even writing about music, it's very much very ephemeral. It's a sort of you take what you can. But once I stopped worrying about that, it was easier to notice a lot of things that were just sort of opportunities that were sort of passing my way that maybe I wouldn't have done because they're not really, you know, what would they be for sort of a teaching career or what would they be for sort of a more standard music career, but I was like, oh, well, that looks like fun. I can do that. And that's a lot of what I've been doing mm-hmm. since then is just trying to notice opportunities when they come along and make them, you know, go into them. And especially if it's something where it's, well, I'm not sure I know that, but I can learn a lot about it. So I can.
You may be absent-minded, but you are diligent about learning new things. And
yes.
then once you note them down, you seem to be able to
once I write them down, then I can forget them and learn something else is kind of how my brain works. So it's
and you keep your hands literally in music because you have a church job.
I do have
right?
I have a church
what
job.
What do you do?
I play the organ and direct the choir at the Presbyterian Church in Sudbury, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very New England thing to do.
Right.
I have an office that looks out on a Revolutionary War graveyard. first time I saw that, I'm like, well, I'm in New England.
Yeah.
But it's but it is great because I have an all-volunteer choir, which I love, because it's they are there for the love of it, and it forces you to, you know, you're putting on a little performance week in, week out, and so you're constantly dealing with that very practical side of music, which I love. And which yeah. I think is because I think that always being in the mind of just how physical an activity making music is, whether you're, you know, at the keyboard or whether you're singing, it's something that's very easy to forget, especially because, you know, now we, you know, interact with music quite a bit through media or through recordings in which it seems very disembodied. And to be able to sort of bring it back into that physical aspect of music making is something I find just incredibly important and incredibly important perspective for writing about music and for thinking about music. So having that church job is extremely important because it just keeps you grounded in actually making music and what that activity is.
And I think the reader feels that and finds that in your reviews and essays in the Globe and New Music Box and in your book. And, you know, it's an old saw that musicologists don't like music. Some of them don't, or some of them at least don't seem to show up at concerts. But the way of having your feet in both of these worlds, thinking about music, making it with volunteers, with amateurs in the best sense, and having the physicality of playing the organ and conducting a choir or singing, demonstrating singing while you're rehearsing and learning pieces with them. I envy you your ability to do these and your opportunities. And of course, you have a family in the making, so it's good to have jobs.
Yes. Jobs are real nice.
I bet that I'm not alone in hearing that piece, I guess we could call it, hearing that entity and saying, oh gosh, I do remember that. And I think that anybody over age X remembers this mini fad of discoized versions of great hits. But the great hit of that was, of course, A Fifth of Beethoven. And talk about appropriation of the four notes or recognition that they're important. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's what's interesting is a lot of people, this is A Fifth of Beethoven by Walter Murphy, and it was credited as Walter Murphy and the Big Apple Band because his label, for some reason, told him that it would be easier to market it if it was coming from a group rather than an individual. And especially after it became a big hit, this sort of irked Walter Murphy a little bit, and he there's a quote in which he basically complains like, well, you know, I did everything, I did the arrangement, I played all the instruments, I did the recording, and he gets, you know, he doesn't even mention Beethoven, which I don't think it's sort of like a fault on his part. I think it's just a sign of just how much you know, it had reached the point where it's just sort of common cultural property. It's just there. It's something to be
taken.
There
are notes, and the four notes of Beethoven are a note.
Yeah.
Just use it.
Yeah, right. And I think he was, you know, so he was very, you know, an early adopter of that idea that, you know, cultural material is there to be remixed and there to be remade in some way. And A Fifth of Beethoven was very, very successful. It was, a lot of people know it from the movie Saturday Night Fever. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it was put in the movie in an effort to boost the movie's popularity because it had been a number one single even before the movie was made. So that's why they actually paid the money to license it, to get it into the movie itself. And one of the other really interesting things about it is because it's taking a performance of Beethoven's Fifth and putting it to a steady beat, because disco is all about a steady beat, mm-hmm. and most performances as Beethoven's Fifth do not even, right. do not, it's just, it's performance practice. It slows down, it speeds up, there's fermatas, it's got, you know, retardandos and all that. But because it, now we have this version of it that's set to a steady beat, that made it easy to sample once the hip-hop era started. And so then all of a sudden you get the second generation of pop versions of Beethoven's Fifth, but most of them actually you trace back not to the original or not to an orchestral performance of it, but it gets traced back, they're sampling the Walter Murphy version. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's a great way of just how many steps removed you can get,
right.
and but it's still, it's working its way in. And so just being able to sort of borrow that, a little bit of the grandeur of the piece and the mechanism by which that happens, and sort of this wayward way it keeps re-entering the culture. And yeah, it was, I think the fact that it was Beethoven's Fifth is probably why it was by far the most successful one.
Yeah.
There were a couple previous versions. There were competing disco versions of Jesus, Joy of Man's Desiring that were out for a while. Also on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack is a wonderful disco Mussorgsky thing that David Shire did called A Night on Disco Mountain, mm-hmm. which actually is quite enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But it's the Fifth of Beethoven that really had the traction to sort of take its own place. It's almost not even like it's almost reached the point where it's its own cultural artifact,
right.
that sits
right.
on the shelf next to Beethoven's Fifth, right. which is, I think, a fairly remarkable thing.
And of course, before that, and we don't have time to go into the detail, and we also want people to read the book, but there the use in Warner Brothers cartoons, in other aspects of popular culture, in commercials, and also in this whole idea of long hair music.
Yeah.
Was it the Digel commercial? There's some commercial where the conductor, an elderly conductor, comes out and plays bum 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 bum, and then later he plays some ditty for the music. So there's definitely that, and then going today into sampling hip-hop and so on. But this is also makes a nice segue into a person who was writing about these things before they were even happening in many ways, and also was kind of predicting the past in terms of that Beethoven could be fragmented.
Yeah.
And that's Theodor Adorno. And you have a very nice summation of who Adorno was, and because so many people who write about Adorno and philosophy put the music stuff to the side, and the music people, well, I think you have this great quote from one of his analysts, I don't mean psychoanalysts, but that there's something about an Adorno essay that within the first four words you think you must have started in the middle or missed the beginning.
Yes. Yeah, so. Adorno is, I may have been the last generation of sort of college music students in which sort of Adorno would come up.
Mm-hmm.
And now I feel like it's, although his time may be coming back, just
right.
because he did preemptively try to analyze so much of what we think of as really sort of a modern media landscape. Back in the 30s and 40s, he saw it all coming. And he was very concerned with sort of how recording and how radio at that time, which was
right.
the mass media of the time, how this affected sort of what we think of as listening, what we think of as art, what we think of as sort of music. And he's a very difficult writer to read, and almost purposefully so. He's of a piece with the German Romantics in that he is pushing the language as far as he possibly can. Mm-hmm. And to the point where it's the language almost starts to you can't quite get a grasp on it. And that was very purposeful. He wanted to sort of push it past sort of the limitations of language. But I think just the fact that he was so perceptive in how mass media and recording sort of naturally pushed people to hear things in smaller and smaller fragments.
Mm-hmm.
That it's kind of a shame that he's not read more. And so that's one of the reasons I really wanted him in the book, and it's one of the reasons I really wanted him at the end of the book, because he so wonderfully just sums up so much of what the book is about. I think he said at one point that, you know, the pattern today is, this is a not an exact quote because I can't remember exactly, but pattern today is people listen to Beethoven's Fifth as if it's a set of quotations from Beethoven's Fifth.
Right.
That
right.
might have been one of the only times in his life he actually said something pithy, but I think it is it's exactly dead on, and I think it's that sort of idea is really what he was trying to get at through a lot of his writing. And because he was an extremely cultured person in a very old-fashioned way. He's a very modern thinker, but he was an extremely cultured person in a very old-fashioned way. He was also a very, very good composer
mm-hmm.
before he decided to give up composition and turn to philosophy, but he's probably the best composer who ever became a professional philosopher. And so when he talks about music, he talks about it from an extremely knowledgeable place. And I think that's really what sets him apart from so many other even, you know, great philosophers who have talked about Beethoven or talked about music, is that he really knew the ins and outs of music. He knew the building blocks. He knew how it fit together. He knew what it was to write a piece of music. And so when he starts talking about how people are listening to music, he really acutely feels that gulf
mm-hmm.
between the way that mass media makes people listen and really what the composer went through to create it. And I think in a lot of ways it's very poignant. And so I think I love having Adorno in the book, because he's just such a wonderful thinker. You know, even in all the things he got wrong, he's just always so provocative.
I have to say, you have the best and remarkably succinct confrontation with answer to what many people know or think they know about Adorno, that his infamous dismissal of jazz. And I think you do the best job I've seen of not defending it, but explaining why
yeah.
he didn't get it and why that shouldn't stand in the way of reading him about Beethoven or Mahler or
yeah.
other people. Still, one draws one's own conclusions, but he, as you've already demonstrated, and you end that chapter and the main body of the book by saying, even after all the intrusions of poetics, program, sentiment, and technology, semi-paraphrasing here, Adorno thought there was still a fresh way that Beethoven could hit you
yes.
Anew. He thought it could still be done. To know what the Fifth has been burdened with is to know what to clear away. You have to start somewhere. That is Guerrieri writing there. And I'm wondering if to close, you might read from the end of the epilogue. You're not giving anything away because it takes us back to the beginning. But when we get to this point now, we hear it in a very different way. And maybe if you could read from Still. And this is, of course, about the infamous night where Beethoven played almost everything he'd ever written and
yes,
premiered
this was
night.
the premiere of the Fifth Symphony, which was also the premiere of the Sixth Symphony, which was also the premiere of the Fourth Piano Concerto, which was also the premiere of the Choral Fantasy. And my favorite bit of that is he was very afraid that if he put the Fifth Symphony at the end of the concert, that people would be too tired to hear it with fresh ears. So his solution to that was to write the Choral Fantasy and make the concert longer. That's a very Beethoven
reaction. When we have you back sometime, which I hope will be soon, and I hope with some annual or whatever regularity, one of the many things we didn't get to do is I would love to hear you talk about the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Symphonies.
Yes.
But for now, we'll hear you talk about Beethoven and opening night.
Yeah, so the opening night did not go well at all. It was a very, very, very bad performance. But still, Beethoven convinced himself that the concert had gone over well. And this is a quote. The public nevertheless applauded the whole performances with enthusiasm. That's a quote from Beethoven. Though he expected the worst from the critics. Scribblers in Vienna, he said, will certainly not fail to send again to the Musikalische Zeitung some wretched stuff directed against me, he predicted. Now, the Allgemeine Musikalische Zeitung was the most important German language music magazine of the time. And eventually it was where E.T.A. Hoffmann would publish his review of the Fifth Symphony that really made it an incredibly famous piece. At this time, though, the Allgemeine Musikalische Zeitung, perhaps having caught some glimpse of the Fifth Symphony's future all-purpose ubiquity, opted for discretion. And this was their entire review of the piece. This new grand symphony by Beethoven, in its fashion, in accordance both with the ideas and with their treatment, once again stands so much apart from all others that even the trained listener must hear it several times before he can make it his own and arrive at a definite opinion.
It's a wonderful discovery. It's a wonderful reminder to us. It's a wonderful conclusion, and it's just one of many wonderful examples of why Matthew Guarieri's The First Four Notes, Beethoven's Fifth, and The Human Imagination is a book you're going to really enjoy and learn from. Alex Ross says, a bit like Beethoven himself, Guarieri finds a cosmos in Four Notes. And don't just take it from me or Alex Ross. Stephen Colbert has had Matthew Guarieri on his program as resident musicologist, or?
No. I'm not that good.
As joke teller, or? All right,
I'm
we'll have to
good.
Find it. Okay. Well, you're very good at this, and we urge you to follow Matthew as well via the Boston Globe, New Music Box, and this wonderful book from Knopf. Thanks for coming back to Niles and for making your WFMT debut. As we say, we hope we'll have you here often again in the future. Thanks so much.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Music that we heard at the top of the show, a collage of the first four notes, well, each twice, so the first eight notes of the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven, taken from versions regarded by Matthew Guarieri. 1913, Arthur Nikisch, the Berlin Philharmonic. 1968, Glenn Gould, solo piano. 1970, Pierre Boulez and the New Philharmonia. Boulez's only Beethoven recording, quite hard to find. We brought it to you from an LP. Carlos Kleiber, famous Vienna 1975 recording. John Elliott Gardner and his Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique from 1995. And that great musical figure, Walter Murphy, 1976, a fifth of Beethoven. We'd like to thank, of course, Matthew Guarieri for being our guest this week and last. Eric Arunas for recording this program. Matt DeStefano for putting the programs together with us and making them sound great. We'd also like to thank Samuel Galloway for his assistance, Tony Va, and Alex Ross. We thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, RENTAP at AOL.com. Chime in at WFMT.com or visit the WFMT Facebook page and let us know what you thought. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can hear this or any of our other programs on the always free Critical Thinking podcast, which is also where you can hear part one of this conversation if you missed it last week. We go out now with Carlos Kleiber playing the first movement, Allegro con brio, of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week. Thank you. Thank you.